Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more movie and nostalgia podcasts, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, the podcast where we revisit pop culture from our youth to see if it's as good all grown up. I'm Jordan Poland Clark, and with me is my co-host, Kara Gail O'Regan.
Hello.
And with us today is Cage Club co-founder, Mike Manzi.
Hello. Hi, Mike. Hi.
So today we are going to talk about the 1975 cult classic, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I had not seen since I was 16. And even then, I think I only saw it once. What about you guys?
I was very into this movie in like middle. Really? Oh, very much so. It's a rite of passage for a lot of weirdos, and I was one of those weirdos. So in like middle school and high school, I was very into it, and then I just kind of got sick of it, and I don't think I've seen it since. So it was really fun to revisit.
Not since high school.
Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe okay. Once okay. In college, but that's it.
Yeah, I had always sort of known about the Rocky Horror Picture Show growing up and heard about it as like a midnight movie and people would get dressed up to go see it. I never did, but it was always like playing at the theaters I was going to see some films growing up, but I never saw it until high school. And I also don't think I've seen it since high school, to be quite honest. I think I watched it a lot when I first discovered it because it just blew my mind, like, you know, most things.
As it should.
Yeah. Like, just, you know, watching this right in the middle of puberty, you know, it's like probably the perfect time to discover this movie. But yeah, and I was very excited to come back and revisit this. We're going to talk about a different program on my return to the show, because I haven't been here since The Net.
That was a long time ago.
It was our second episode.
It wasn't even officially Wistful Thinking yet, I don't believe. So this is my...
No, it was still...
Well, we had the title.
Okay. But it wasn't the format. So I was very psyched that you guys sort of were like, you want to watch this instead? And I was like, oh yeah, I've been meaning to get back to it, and you know, this is the perfect time of year to watch it. And yeah, I loved it.
Awesome.
Did you guys used to go to the screenings?
I think I went to like maybe two of them, but it's a little much for me. I don't like loud noises. I don't like people flapping around in my face, so I prefer to like stay home and watch it.
I've always wanted to go. I haven't. It's funny. I just found out that in the town that I grew up, that like right down the street from where I live now, they're actually going to start doing it every other week at the movie theater there. Like,
that's a lot.
It's crazy. Like the timing. I can't make it this weekend because I'm going to see Mandy, the new Nick Cage movie, so I can't make that. I got priorities, you know, Cage Club priorities, of course. But I would love to try and get there at least once. Like, it just looks like a blast, like an experience, just like a one-of-a-kind thing, you know, like something you can't get anywhere else. And I don't think I'd ever become a regular, but I'd definitely love to pop my cherry one day.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth it at least once, because it is an experience. And I'm curious, like, how the experience of going would be different now. Not just, like, because I'm older, but, like, also, like, the broader culture has changed so much. And, like, there's so much more queer media out there. And, like, I feel like the changes in the culture might also be reflected in the audience and like how they respond to the movie or how they dress for the event and stuff like that. So yeah, it would be interesting to go at least one more time.
Well, so this is, do you guys this feel like this is a positive representation of that culture? Like, I would, you know, because I would feel like even nowadays, like, this shouldn't even be a midnight movie. Do it at, like, 12 in the afternoon.
Right. I mean, that's the other reason why I haven't gone again, is that it's just, I'm a night person, but I don't want to go out that late.
But, well, that's what, okay, so I saw this. I don't know why, but for some reason, my, like, high school friends and I decided that, like, we were going to go see a screening. we were like 16. And so we watched it beforehand, and then like we watched it the week before or something, and then went to the screening. And like, I remember very little about it, except for that it was Christmas time. And so in addition to like being a whole thing, there was a Santa Claus there who, and all the virgins had to come sit on his lap and get a present.
Oh God.
Which was, I thought it was very uncomfortable. I didn't like it, but like, whatever. And we all got made fun of because we were super young too.
Yeah.
But so I remember that. And then we were also sitting like right in the front, and my friend next to me kept falling asleep, and one of the actors kept cueing me to poke her awake every time he saw that she was asleep. So yeah, watching stuff late at night is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is actually considered to be the longest running release in film history because it's never actually been pulled by 20th Century Fox from its original 1975 release.
Oh, that's a great...
cinemas. Yep.
That's an awesome title for it to be holding right now. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is, right, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure this was like, if not the first midnight movie, it definitely gave like midnight movie its sort of name and reputation. And then like, you know, stuff like The Room, right? Like,
this is why we have The Room, right?
Well, yeah, right. Like, at least screenings, and why people throw like spoons at the screen for that and all kinds of things too. It's,
yeah,
right, it's definitely from this.
Well, before the Rocky Horror, like the way that they got the idea for the midnight screenings for Rocky Horror was that John Waters' Pink Flamingos, which came out in 1972, and then also Reefer Madness, the 1930s anti-cannabis propaganda
film.
Have
you guys seen Reefer Madness?
Yeah, it's bonkers.
I've never seen
it. It's so great. I just watched it for the first time with my dad.
That's funny. It's wild. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. I just had to put that in because it was excellent.
Yeah. But they actually had been making money in midnight showings nationwide. So one of the executives at Fox was able to talk distributors into midnight screenings of Rocky Horror because it didn't do well when it first came out.
That's something that's super clever that no one at a major studio would do now or which is like tap into the zeitgeist in that manner where it's like, whoa, John Waters, Pink Flamingo, like this outsider filmmaker, because also, you know, queer filmmaker, right?
Yep.
Like represents and all. So like to be able to like say this is a good thing and like not exploit it, but like treat it as like a viable market that could actually be, you know, gain ground and like gain sort of like a cult following, which it did, which it ended up doing and stuff. Like, you would never see anybody nowadays like pull something like that off. Like, no one is in touch with, I feel like, it feels like no one at the major studios is truly in touch with like what's happening in the streets to the extent that whoever was in charge of Rocky Horror actually figured out what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand though, you do have studios kind of, you know, cynically cashing in on the push for diversity and inclusion. But I think also, like, the way that subcultures exist now versus how they did in the 70s, where, like, people actually needed to, like, congregate in physical spaces for that sort of thing to even exist, versus the internet now. So it's, I don't know, it's hard to kind of compare the two.
But I also think, like, if we're looking at, like, kind of cult status midnight movies, like, oftentimes it has... It's just that kind of magic that accidentally happens, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you can do that on purpose.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. People try to do that on purpose and they just become miserable failures of movies. It's like when they try to make a bad movie for the fun of it, right? Instead of the movies that, you know, turn out to be bad but enjoyable because they were genuine and done, you know, because they were trying to make a serious movie or whatever, and then it, you know what I'm saying? Then it, like, turns out to be bad. Like, like your Samurai Cops or Gymkata or, like, The Room and stuff like that. Like, those movies feel sincere. And so, you know, that's why they're fun. It doesn't matter that they're bad. But then you can feel it sometimes when people are forcing it to be a cult film or something, and they just don't it feels like you just don't get it. Like, it's not something you can force. It's just what the society decides.
Right.
You know, they're ultimately the judge.
This movie made me feel like The Room, though, where, like, for the first, like, 20 to 30 minutes, I was so on board. It was perfect. And then for, like, 45 minutes in the middle, I was like, ugh, this is so hard to watch.
It's a lot. Like, it's overbearing. Like, it's an induction, you know? That's how I kind of feel about it. Like, we are Brad and Janet. Like, our everything about us has been stripped down, and we're just being, or at least at the time I first saw it, just exposed to an entire world I didn't really know existed. Like,
yeah,
like this. Like, I was into horror and science fiction, but I'd never seen anything like this, and especially nothing like Tim Curry before.
Yeah, I mean, even like, yeah, so even though I feel that way, I think that's more like, I wonder if I saw this as the musical, if I saw this on stage.
Oh yeah, yeah.
If I would feel differently, because I think for me it has more to do with not the actual content or the acting, because that's kind of spectacular, and more to do with like the way that it's actually put together. Mm-hmm. It's just very, very easy to get lost in. Mm-hmm. There's just too many things. It never breathes. Like, you never have a chance to catch up to it almost. Mm-hmm. Once it gets going.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. I've forgotten how sort of fast-paced it is. Like, I was at first going to just sort of write down every time a song started, but then I was like, wait a second.
You can't.
Yeah,
you,
like,
too many songs.
It's almost entirely sang, this movie. You know, it's, yeah, it's more like an opera or something.
Yeah.
Which I have no problem with, but, like, right, something about the way that it is sung or the way that it's structured, I couldn't pay attention to like half of the words in most of the songs. That also just could be me and the way that I receive information. That could be my own problem.
Yeah. I have problems with that too in musicals at times when songs are exposition heavy also, and yeah, they don't repeat enough or something. And there's also definitely times when they're not singing and they're not explaining things. They're just sort of, you know, like cracking jokes or double entendres, and or they're just teasing each other, you know? So it doesn't help that when they're not singing, they're not really explaining what's really happening either.
Yeah, before I sat down to watch it, I like read the plot summary on the Wikipedia article and was like, I don't remember any of this. Because when I tried to like think about like what the plot was, I was like, I don't know, like a couple squares show up to a castle full of weirdos, and then there's a golden god, and then they swim and everyone looks great in thigh-high fishnets, and that's all I can remember.
Everyone does look great.
Amazing, right?
Everyone looks incredible. Great. Like, I remember
Susan
Sarandon's
boobs are like incredible.
She looks so much like Betty Davis in this movie.
It was, oh yeah,
just,
she
like,
really does.
Creeping me out almost. I was like, this is weird. But I remember the first time I saw Columbia sitting on top of a jukebox in that golden tuxedo.
I love that costume.
Like, I definitely changed that day. Like, I didn't realize, like, what was possible until I was like, okay, now I'm, like, completely, like, blown away. It's, like, possible.
Yeah.
It's just, like, she just jumped off the screen. It's just, like a cartoon character come to life or something. It was just crazy.
Yeah, I dyed my hair the color of Magenta's hair for, like, 5 years. I forgot that was the reason why until I watched this, and I was like, oh yeah, I forgot. First of all, I forgot I had hair that color for that long. And then second of all, like, this is where I got the idea for it.
I definitely now with like Halloween coming up, I'm considering like a Riff Raff costume or something. Well, that maybe like they'll have like a Halloween showing down the street in town that I'll go to. I don't know, but like, it's definitely watching this definitely, you know, I'm already love Halloween, but it just gets me so much more into the spirit because it's, you know, such a show. Like, it's the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like, it's right in the title. Like, it's almost as if these people know they're being filmed or something. Like, mm-hmm. like they're putting on a show for Brad and Janet, but it's really the audience. And even Tim Curry, like, looks at the camera a few times and, like, gives a winking nod or something like that. And it's just terrific. Like, even if I don't always understand what's happening or, you know, it's overstuffed and it's just, you know, at times just pure madness. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, I love it. It kind of reminds me, and this might sound crazy, but we just recorded an episode for Atomic Blonde on the Watch the Throne podcast, and like, that movie is basically like a standard like spy film, but then like totally like stylized in this like soaked in neon sort of like amazing like electricity, like the way it's shot. And this is like someone was just like, I'm gonna remake Frankenstein, and then like this is what happened. Like it's basically just Frankenstein's monster, you know, like he creates a monster, but it's from the mind of a guy, you know, who's steeped in like this culture that is not part of the mainstream, so that when it comes out like this, it takes everybody sort of by surprise. Like, it's hard just not to look at this.
Yeah, I was thinking about how, I mean, it was mind-blowing to us like as kids, but can you imagine how mind-blowing it would have been to like people in 1975?
Yeah, right? Like,
that's something I was considering this time. Like, I feel like the culture today would be way more into this and accepting of it, and may not even think that all that crazy, you know?
No, I mean, in a world where we have RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah.
You know, and things, you know, right. And that's just like one example. But yeah, I mean, it just is a completely different culture that we live in. You know, like glam rock was a thing, but that's about it.
This is so beyond that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you figure Bowie is most people's sort of like reference for glam rock, and it's like because he's David F. and Bowie, you know, like it's because he was basically like a god, like you know, like but yet he was still sort of what the mainstream knew about it. This is like the deep sort of underground layer, the like, you know, you dig a little deeper into glam rock, and then this is where you get sort of behind the public eye or something, more behind closed doors sort of feel.
Yeah, they actually, in the stage production that preceded the movie, they had the actors do their own makeup, which often happens in theater because you're working with small budgets. But for the movie, they actually got the Pierre LaRoche, who had previously been a makeup artist for people like Mick Jagger and David Bowie, to redesign makeup for each character. And he's actually responsible for the Bowie lightning bolt makeup.
Oh, the Ziggy Stardust?
Yeah.
Like the eye?
Yep. So, like, between that and then, like, the costumes, which are incredible. And apparently, I was reading a lot about the costume designer who said that she like didn't do any research when she was designing the costume.
I love that too.
That's even though I'm like an obsessive researcher, I just think that that's awesome that she was able to kind of like cobble this stuff together, a lot of which I mean she in her own book is attributed to like basically giving the punk movement their style. I don't know if anyone's actually verified that information. It's a little suspect coming from her own
book.
But
isn't that... But didn't, like... Because I read that, but, like, didn't... I don't believe that.
I don't really believe that.
Didn't the style come from, like... Oh, God, I can't remember their names.
There's,
The people who worked with the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, like Malcolm McLaren.
Like Vivian Westwood. But like, isn't that where that came from?
Well, so...
But it seems like they watched this movie.
Oh, for sure. And, I mean...
Yeah, maybe.
That leather jacket that Frankenfurter wears at one point, I'm like, Jesus. Like, that... I knew people who had that, like, exact same jacket in high school.
Oh, yeah. I had...
But the things that are, like, specifically attributed to her are ripped fishnet stockings, which I did wear as a teenager. Glitter and colored hair were all, like, directly attributed to Rocky Horror.
I had green hair when I was a junior. Dyed it green, but...
I had every color hair.
You did, too, at one point.
My hair started to break off of my head.
Oh, my God, the same thing happened to me.
Really?
Yeah.
What the same person?
So weird. Yeah.
On the
all the time.
On the costume note, I mean, obviously, aside from Columbia's, you know, tuxedo, but you know the party guests, right? they used to, and they still do to a degree, creep the hell out of me. I think they're supposed to be aliens, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't, right? They're Transylvanians and stuff. Yeah. So, but that to me is like the scariest part, the idea that they're just kind of standing up on, you know, looking at them at the lab, and they're always just sort of onlookers, and that whole like voyeuristic sort of mentality of it and everything. They just creep me out, but I love it. I love it. I don't know. It's like one of those weird sort of nightmares things like that pop into my head once in a while, but I like it. I don't know. It's crazy.
Oh. I agree with you that I think they're the weirdest part, but I don't think I like it.
Why not?
A little too creepy.
It's, yeah, it's like a little too like culty.
That,
okay. Although yeah. it didn't occur to me that they were aliens until you just said that, and that helps a little bit.
Yeah, because I didn't even pick up on that until like one, two or three viewings, to be honest, because there's so much to absorb in this movie. Like the music alone, I remember I owned the soundtrack and used to listen to it in the car, you know, back when there were tape decks in the car and stuff, like in the 90s. But there's so much to absorb. I didn't even pick up on the whole like planet Transylvania or the galaxy transsexual, like all that. I just thought they were talking about, you know, Europe. Like the first time I saw this, I didn't even realize like it took place in the American Deep South, like, and that it's like partially sort of like a commentary on, you know, all of those sort of repressed sexual, you know, feelings that go along with whatever and happening down in the South, and not just the South, but America in general and the mainstream and everything. So it's crazy how every time I watch this, I'm picking up on new things.
Yeah, the costume designer also, I'm going to try and find this quote because I thought it was hilarious. Here it is. She said, "When I designed Rocky, I never looked at any science fiction movies or comic books. One just automatically knows what a spacesuit looks like the same way one intuitively knows how Americans dress. I had never been to the United States, but I had this fixed idea of how people looked there. Americans wore polyester so their clothes wouldn't crease, and their trousers were always a bit too short. And since they're very keen on sports, white socks and white t-shirts played an integral role in their wardrobe. Of course, since doing Rocky, I have been to the United States and admit it is a bit of a generalization, but my ideas worked perfectly for Brad and Janet." I just think that's hilarious.
That's what I love, that she was like, "I didn't do any research and I got it right. Good job, me."
Yeah, that's awesome, but, though.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
Well, and like on top of that, that like her no research and like people like mimicked it like right away, you know?
It became like a standard, right? Yeah. Like I remember like Meatloaf's jacket, right? He's got like a leather jacket and he's got like leopard like skin on the lapels and stuff. Like my friends and I did that to our leather jackets in high school, and we had like, you know, sheriff stars and things like that hanging off. And yeah, definitely she changed things for sure. Like this is a stylistic marvel.
Yeah,
I love those aliens, like when Riff Raff and Magenta are in their actual spacesuits at the end. Unbelievable. Just gorgeous.
Yeah, there's really, like, not a single costume in this where I'm like, I kind of phoned that one in, even though she totally did kind of phone it in.
Well, it's great that Brad's just walking around in underwear for the, like, and same with Rocky, basically. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of phoning it in, but it's also, like, making it work. Like,
you know what I hadn't picked up on before? The makeup artist actually created a little plug for Rocky's belly button so that it was smooth instead of having a belly button, since he was a creation of Frankenfurter and not actually a human fetus.
Oh. I never noticed that.
Yeah.
Very smart.
And they did it all on a $1,600 costume budget.
That's like no money.
I mean, it's not, but you could do a lot with $1,600, yeah, I think, like especially in the 70s.
You just you don't get to make duplicates, right? You just, everything is a one-off. And
well, they actually did have to do duplicates for like specifically for the pool scene, because they would have to have like one version of the corsets drying while the others were being worn on set.
Oh, wow. Because I totally was watching that going like, these people are suffering for their art, because just in this, they're soaking and they're smiling and they're kicking really high and they're just trying to do this.
I love that scene so much.
Oh, it's amazing.
That might be my favorite part.
Yeah, I think it's my favorite part. But the like castle or like the mansion that they filmed in was kind of in disrepair, and it was like freezing in there. They had no heat, no bathrooms, and Susan Sarandon told the studio heads about it, and they told her she was complaining too much, but then she got pneumonia after filming the pool scene. And according to Richard O'Brien, she was shaking with fever and should have been under medical supervision, but refused to stop working. There was a warm room that they created in the estate that was filled with space heaters, but then the room caught on fire. So
Too warm.
Oh, man.
Okay, here's my question for you, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little bit rapey.
Oh,
there's two
yeah.
little bit rapey
I
parts.
I wrote down, oh, wow, that's rape.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because that's also what I thought. And that, I don't know, that was the only part of this to me that I was like, ooh, no.
Yeah, that was interesting to watch as an adult, because what happens is Frankenfurter sneaks into both Brad and or Janet's room first and then Brad's room disguised as their significant other.
As each other.
Right.
First he's disguised as Brad and then he's disguised
right.
as
Janet. And so he's welcomed into their beds thinking that he's somebody else. And they begin to engage in sexual activity, and then they realize that it's actually Dr. Frankenfurter. And both of them protest, and then they are like, okay.
They give in pretty bad.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have a lot of mixed feelings about that scene.
You guys missed the other one. You didn't catch the other one? Well, I mean, it's not on screen, but it's definitely implied that... after he builds Rocky and he kills Meatloaf, that he takes Rocky to bed. Mm-hmm. And the next shot of him is like Rocky laying on his stomach, like with his legs spread from the back, like sleeping and stuff. So mm-hmm. like he certainly had his way. Like he just built Rocky to do that.
Right.
Which
right.
is, and yeesh.
Yeah. An automaton can't consent.
It's so. The horror show part of it, you know? Like, I don't like it, but again, yeah. like, you know, you have to be reminded that this guy isn't a good person. Like, he's not a person at all. He's an alien, but, like, you know, right. you have to be reminded, like, these are evil people, like, what they're doing, because, goddamn, when they start singing and dancing and all that shit, like, you really
like,
just want to
party.
Totally
on board.
Yeah, you just yeah. want to fucking party down with them, but, like, he's chopping up people and feeding them to you, and, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, this guy is a demon for real. Like
I also didn't get that that's what they were eating until I read about it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That they're
yeah,
eating.
He like,
I just checked out.
Yeah. Throws the big like sheet off the table, and it's the coffin filled with like the half remains.
Oh, you know what? I do remember that. I blocked it out because it was gross.
Yeah, because everything is such like a great time, but it, you know, it's not. Everything is just disguised as a good time, but what's really going on is like. Very dark. Like, mm-hmm. look at Brad and Janet. Like, they're kidnapped, basically. They're, like, knock on the wrong door, and
they're like,
not allowed to
they're
leave.
Like, very okay with it, though.
Well, they're, like,
they come
also
around.
Very sort of 50s naive representations
right.
of, like, people and stuff, so it's definitely
yeah,
a satire.
True. And they're just, like, trying to be polite and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, so, to circle back around to the, oh, wow, that's rape.
Yep.
It's, so... I don't like the way that they did that, but if you think about it in context, this is 1975. It's like the sexual revolution is in full swing. And so a lot of people of Brad and Janet's generation were these like uptight squares who had all of these ideas about morality and sexuality and that sort of thing and how we express our gender and our sexual interest in people. And then they come to this castle and kind of get their minds blown, among other things. And then, I mean, I kind of really love the bisexual representation in this movie. And like,
no, I do too.
You know, and also like the way that Janet finds out that like, oh, she really likes sex and she wants to mm-hmm. have more of it, you know?
Right.
So like, there are those things mixed in with it that make me like want to be super on board with it, and then I'm like, ooh, but yeah.
Because so like her song with Rocky, I feel like that's solid, right? When you know, the touch me, touch me, touch me.
That seems consensual.
Yeah, okay. Like that seems like the right way to represent what they're trying to say. Whereas the stuff with Frankenfurter sneaking into their bed just seems like a little like off key, or like, you know what I'm saying? Like kind of like a sour note. Like I get what they're saying, but they're kind of implying like something else in my mind and stuff.
Right. Yeah. But also different time, you know,
certainly.
Like, you know, that sort of thing. Like if somebody did that and then you tried to press charges against them, like you wouldn't be able to, you know. So like legally, not that that makes it okay, but just like again, like within the context of like when this movie was made, it's like still actually very progressive in a lot of ways.
I don't even understand how this got made.
Yeah, I'm right with you there on that one because. Yeah.
Well, it happened in England, I think. You know,
yeah. Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's
it
a huge right. part of it.
Yeah,
okay. That this was that not an American movie. It was super low budget. They could have made it. They had the opportunity to make it with a much larger budget if they cast stars in the roles, and they actually turned down the big budget so that they could make it with people who had been in the original play, and then made a compromise that they would cast somewhat known American actors as Brad and Janet.
Was Susan Sarandon known at the time?
I don't know if she was like a big star, but I think she had been in some things.
Yeah, this was like her fifth movie, so I didn't like look really deep into what the movies before this was, but this was definitely at the beginning of her career.
Now,
yeah.
Surprisingly enough, I had actually known Tim Curry growing up as a little kid
because
I used to like rent videos where he was like a children's star almost or something. Yeah. And
yeah,
like
I definitely knew him before this as something else, but this was his first
like
movie
what?
Role.
So I used to get these videos called Unicorn Tales, I think they were called, or something like that. Yeah. And they were just like retelling of like famous, like fairy tales. And if I think that was the name of them, but like Robin Williams was like the Frog Prince and things like that. And like Tim Curry, I think like, hosted them or was in one. I can't remember, you know, it was like 5 or 6 years old, like we're going way back, but like I had known him, I'd known like who he was and was familiar with him. I got him mistaken with Freddie Mercury for a few years, but other than that, like I knew about
I
him.
I can see that. Yeah. Well, he was in Annie, he played Rooster Hannigan.
Yep
He was in Clue as Wadsworth.
Yeah, I saw Clue after this. Yeah,
okay. He was in, what were the other things?
I forgot he was in Annie. Oh, wow. And Bernadette Peters, right? Mm-hmm. Was like his sister or something. Yeah.
He was the voice of Hexus in Ferngully, which is a movie that we definitely need to do on this
Who's
podcast.
Hexus?
The scary, like, oil monster.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yep.
So speaking of, just if I'm, may I interrupt for just a moment, because you hit something that just made me think of something. Like Tim Curry doing voiceover just seems perfect to me.
Yeah.
And if I may, can I let out my Frankenfurter impression?
Oh, please, by all means,
yeah.
Do.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if it's gonna come across that well, but you've got to sort of do it like this, or maybe like that. But give it a try. I don't know. I've been on an impression tear across the network lately, so you know, catch me on Kyle's show doing Charlton Heston impressions, Cinemakers doing Pacino impressions.
Impression,
I always used to try and talk like Tim Curry for some reason, but I don't know.
Well, so I had listened to, he was on Fresh Air in 2005 with Terry Gross, and it's a wonderful, wonderful interview. Highly recommend taking a listen. It was right, I guess, as Spamalot was happening. And he said that he like, for the stage play, he had played Frankenfurter German, like with a German accent. And then one day he was like on the bus and heard a woman talking in like an extremely posh British accent saying like, do you have a home in the country or in the city or like something like that, you know, something very British. And then he realized that, like, oh, he should sound like the Queen. So he he took that very specific royal accent and kind of mixed it a little bit with his own mother's accent. And, like, that was how he came up with the voice for Frankenfurter for the movie.
Because Frankenfurter definitely thinks he's, like, the queen of everything.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yes. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Oh, that's so great. I also love Riff Raff's voice. Mm-hmm. Harry kind of does the little thing with it and stuff. He reminds me a little of, Alan Rickman? Sounds like Alan Rickman, right?
Yeah, kind of.
That's what was in my head the whole time. I was like, damn, that's such a great, great accent.
Yeah, your Riff Raff is a much stronger impression.
Thank you.
But he was also in, I just had it in front of me and then I scrolled past it. Oh, he was in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. He plays a concierge at the hotel.
That's right. As is our current president, has a walk-on cameo in that same hotel.
He was on Tales from the Crypt, at least.
He did, like, it looks like almost exclusively voices in kids' shows.
No, not necessarily.
For, like, many years.
For many years, yeah. Oh, he was on Dinosaurs.
Wait, the Noctemamo? That one? Like, with the pink baby dinosaur? I used to love that show.
You should watch that.
I bet it's not good at all.
Maybe it's not bad. I don't know. He was. I'm sure. He did voice as of King Acorn on the Sonic the Hedgehog cartoon. And he was in Congo. And for some reason, I loved that movie as a kid.
Which one is Congo?
They like go to the Congo and there's like silverback gorillas and stuff.
It's got like Ernie Hudson's in it and they get to like these ancient ruins and there's like a volcano and there's a gorilla that does sign language and her like glove translates it into English, so like she'll sign something and be like Amy hungry Amy hungry.
Oh, with Amy. Yep, yeah, I've seen that. Yep.
He played Long John Silver in Muppet Treasure Island.
Oh, okay.
He was on Captain Planet.
All right, I missed that
one. Mal. Apparently he was like a HAL-like computer called Mal.
I don't think you want to do that, David.
He seems like he is a very excellent stage actor.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Let's see. What else has he been in?
I think he's done
like,
mostly
I feel like
stage
that's
acting.
Probably his jam, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And recently, unfortunately, he did suffer a stroke, but.
Yeah, I saw that.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't he play, like, the professor part in the Rocky Horror TV version or something?
He was the criminologist, the guy who is. Like, which I completely forgot was even in the movie, who is breaking the fourth wall and like is the narrator basically for the story, which I think is a missed opportunity to have him, because the professor uses a wheelchair and like why not use an actor who actually uses a wheelchair in that part, right?
Oh, good call. Yeah, maybe he didn't just have the strength. I think he's kind of getting up there in age.
Yeah, he's like 78, I think, so he's pretty old.
It's great that he's contributed at all, too, though. That's awesome.
Yeah. An interesting thing about the wheelchair use in this movie, it's never really, like, they don't really make a big deal out of it, which is cool. Mm-hmm. And it's important representation for non-paralyzed wheelchair users, I think. Because the majority of people who use wheelchairs aren't paralyzed. However, I think the popular conception of people who use wheelchairs is that they use them because the lower half of their body doesn't work right. And so in this movie you have the professor doing high kicks in the wheelchair, and I love that. I really enjoyed it.
It made me think of Dr. Strangelove. Have either of you seen
not in a long time.
Yeah, also not in a long time. But
the titular character Dr. Strangelove is in a wheelchair but doesn't necessarily it's not that his legs don't work. He's in it for like other reasons and stuff. But I definitely got a sense of that when he started doing like high kicks in this. I was like, oh, he doesn't need it. Or like, it's not because like he needs it, but it's not because his legs kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
There was, I noticed some Nazi stuff in this movie.
Some?
Really? Not picked some, up on previously.
You mean? I mean, the flag flying over their house, like, gave it away for me, like, immediately.
I was like, you've got a black flag
with a white circle and a black lightning bolt through it. I was like, that feels like the Stasi.
I did not pick up on that until, I guess the lab scene, he's, like, the surgical gown that he's wearing has a red triangle on it, which was used by the Nazis to identify their homosexual prisoners. It was usually an upside down pink triangle, which was then repurposed by the gay liberation movement and turned right side up, I guess.
Yeah, like the triangle, right? It's now like kind of a symbol.
And like most iconically used, I think, probably by ACT UP, the activism group, in their Silence Equals Death campaign. That's probably where most people have seen it the most. So I like picked up on that. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, that fits in, you know, with what's going on here. And then after he reveals Rocky, who is kind of an Aryan ideal man, Magenta says it's a triumph of your will, like, which is a reference to the Leni Riefenstahl movie. And I was like,
I didn't think I wanted any of it.
And I wrote down, oh no, is Magenta a Nazi?
No.
But I don't, like,
she's an alien, but it's it's the same social structure, I guess.
I don't know. I just, it was interesting.
And Frankenfurter was originally German too.
I mean, not that I'm saying, like, this is, like, has like Nazi messages to it. I think it's actually of the opposite.
Right. They're taking the piss out of the Nazis in this.
Right.
Sure.
And
they're saying, like, look how ridiculous you look. I think.
Exactly. And this was only 30 years after World War II and after the Holocaust. So, like, that stuff being in there is definitely not at all an accident.
That's such a different context to think about. Like, having it that close.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, it's nuts. That's the thing about this movie, though. Like, there is real sort of depth to it if you want to look for it, you know? Like, it's not just this, like, S&M bondage, like, celebration, but it is that. Like, it is that, of course. But, I mean, it's they're able to treat it as satire as well as be sincere. It's crazy. Like, it's almost meta, but not along the way we know it today of, like, self-referential, like, just obvious stuff. But, like I said earlier, like, Tim Curry does look at the camera, like, two or three times and, like, kind of gives a wink, like, you're following this? Like, can you believe what we're doing? Kind of looks, I feel. So there is definitely that vibe going on there that I was not always quite aware of.
Yeah, and it struck me because we just did Grease and kind of had the same sort of realizations that, like, there's all of this stuff in the movie that was referencing all of this other stuff.
That clicked so hard for me when I heard you guys say, like, Grease is maybe a parody or something of, like, 50s Greaser films. Like, as an adult, I see that perfectly because as a kid, I just thought Grease was hilarious. Like, I just thought it was so funny, like, effortlessly funny. But now I realize it's sort of like the Scary Movie of its time or something. And I'm fine with that. That's cool. It's still a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, it's drawing most heavily, I guess, on, like, the science fiction and horror movies of the kind of early half of the 20th century.
Like, the opening song says it all, right? Like, they mention, like, seven or eight, like, not just actors and actresses, but, like, movie titles and stuff, like, everything from Fay Wray and King Kong to, like, When Worlds Collide and The Man with X-Ray Eyes and stuff, and, like, Claude Rains and everything. So it feels like, that's why I feel like it's like a genuine send up instead of, like, they're not making fun, they're having fun. It's like much more like a camp kind of thing.
For sure.
Because that's their influence there.
And the big old house that they filmed it in, called Oakley Court, was actually used in a number of Hammer films, which were a lot of those old really schlocky horror movies that came out of Britain from that time.
A lot of them starring like Peter Cushing as like Frankenstein or like Sherlock Holmes and stuff, and Christopher Lee played Dracula like 100 times for the Hammer horror films and stuff. Like, just really, like, look a lot like this, like the dining room and the hallway, just drenched in that gothic atmosphere.
Right. It's
really cool. Like, cobwebs on everything.
Yeah. And also, drawing in the beginning of the film on American Gothic, the painting, because you actually have Riff Raff and Magenta, like, standing there, like the man and the woman in that painting, which then, I don't think I had picked up on as a teen.
Yeah, I knew the imagery, because I think we all kind of just know that it's so it's such a famous painting, but I didn't even catch, like, I didn't catch that on first viewing, and then I didn't catch that, like, most of the people at the wedding are the weirdos from the party. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of those, like, going on. And then the American Gothic painting is in the mansion, like, when he opens the clock and the skeleton falls out of it, or he like brushes
which
the
is
skeleton.
A real skeleton, by the way.
Oh,
The skeleton of the woman who commissioned the clock. How fun is that?
She was buried in her own clock.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
And
why isn't that movie coming out this summer?
Right.
What?
Yeah, that was a fun fact to learn.
But that whole American Gothic, like Southern Gothic stuff, like that stuff I love too. Just the atmosphere of that, like that came back in a big way with like True Detective season one in a way, just like getting into the weirdness of the Deep South. And also, like, it's kind of crazy that this is sort of like a British take on America and they ended up sort of like setting it there. I don't know. It's kind of cool. I like that about it, that they targeted the South instead of like LA or New York or something like that, because of, you know, and I guess it is true to a degree that the South is an easier target, so I guess there is that. But
Kara, did you happen to look at what, like, so I know that some stuff was added from the stage version to the movie. Did you look at what?
No, I mean, I did, but I didn't copy it into my notes. Because I was like, nah, that's not important. But
well, then it must not have been, like, super different.
Yeah, I mean, there were just, you know, some minor changes. Some songs were added and stuff. The accent change that I mentioned. Costume changes, I think. So, like, Columbia's sequined costume was created for the film. Magenta had not been in a made costume previously. Magenta played more than one character for the stage. I can't believe this stuff is still in my head. She played like a usher who would sing the science fiction double feature song. And those are her lips, but not her voice. That's actually Richard O'Brien singing in the opening.
Yeah, I heard that they weren't going to let her sing the song, and she's like, well, then I'm not going to be in the movie. And then they're like, well, just come down and look at the set. And she took one look at the set, and she's like, all right, I'll do whatever you want. Like, I got to be involved in this. It doesn't matter. And then so at the end, I think they said it might even been the last day of shooting. They had her come in and do the lip syncing thing, because it's the most they could have done for her to be able to sort of like honor that.
Yeah, and the other thing, the one other thing that was kind of interesting, for the stage production, the same actor would play Eddie and the professor, because the professor is supposed to be his uncle, so they theoretically need to look alike, and so Meatloaf was real bummed that he didn't get to also play the professor, because he had played Eddie / the professor in the Los Angeles stage version. I thought that he was in this movie a lot more, but he shows up, sings a song, and then gets murdered again.
Yeah, he really only has one scene.
Yeah, it's, I totally thought he was in more.
It's too bad he didn't get to play his own uncle, because, like, you know, if you've seen Fight Club, like, he's a really good actor, or he can be a really good actor. He's like a natural. Mm-hmm. He's a natural performer. I mean,
he's fun to watch. Yeah.
I grew up with a lot of Meatloaf playing around the house, believe it or not. Like, my mom just loved those Bat Out of Hell albums. Like, they're just always
they're
playing.
They're classics for a reason.
Exactly. So I was familiar with Mr. O'Day. Is it Milos O'Day, I believe, is his real name or something.
Oh, really?
But yes, more would have been better from him. Yeah, the Eddie stuff is just like it just comes out of nowhere and then it's over immediately and you're just like, what just happened? What?
This is the second Meatloaf movie that we've done on this podcast. Also the second Richard O'Brien movie. Jordan, can you name that movie that we also did on Wistful
Absolutely
Thinking?
Absolutely not. I've seen Meatloaf in something else for this podcast.
Yes, you have.
I hate that this is happening now. There's like so many things you keep bringing up that I'm like, I've seen that? Okay, let me think. Meatloaf. I've seen Meatloaf in something else that's not Fight Club because we haven't done Fight Club for this.
Nope. Mike, would you like to take a guess?
Okay, was it the same?
They Mike were gets it.
Both in the same movie?
Yep.
Wow.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorites.
It's one of your favorites. Spice World?
Yes.
Was it Spice World?
Ding, ding, ding. You got it.
Oh, that's right. Meatloaf was the
He plays the bus driver.
Yeah.
And then Richard O'Brien plays the paparazzi photographer who, like, sneaks out of the
toilet.
Oh,
it makes so much sense. Of course. Only Spice World would have, like, a reunion from Rocky Horror Picture Show to some capacity. Like,
yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh, and do you know what? If you Google Spice World, Rocky Horror Picture Show is one of the suggested movies mm-hmm. that comes up next to it. And now I understand why.
And I actually, when I was looking at the Wikipedia article before I watched Rocky Horror this time around, I noticed that Richard O'Brien's name, like, I had clicked on it in the past, and I was like, oh, that's weird. I don't know who that is. And I clicked on him. And then it was like a more recent photograph where he looks more like the guy that he plays in Spice World. And I was like, oh, my God. So I didn't even remember. But yeah, that's a fun thing. Ooh. Do you know who the studio's first choice was to play Eddie?
Hmm.
At least according to Meatloaf, the Gospel of Meatloaf.
John Goodman, only because they kind of look alike.
That's a good guess, but that's not him. No.
Freddie Mercury.
Also would have been great, but no. Although I feel like Freddie Mercury would have been a great Frankenfurter.
That is also true. I was just trying to think of like some other like glam rock.
And like Riff Raff kind of, I mean, he doesn't look like Bowie, but I could see Bowie maybe doing something like Riff Raff or something.
Get that Labyrinth wig back on.
My goblin friends.
I don't know. Who?
Elvis Presley.
Whoa!
Wait, wasn't he dead by then?
No, he died in 1978, and I know that because he died the day that they shot the sleepover scene in Greece.
Oh, that's right. I heard that on the Grease cast.
Your brain is filled with weird connections now.
No, but,
and
oh,
I can't remember my own name
wait,
most of the time.
Because didn't they,
so
that's what I'm thinking.
Space.
Didn't they want Elvis to play Danny?
Yeah.
And then he was already dead.
Because we just talked about this too, though, is that like they wanted like Elvis 20 years before that to play Danny.
They modeled Danny.
70s
after.
Elvis.
Right.
Danny is sort of like a riff on Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's funny. I couldn't imagine like last days Elvis in Greece. Like, trying to. Greece.
That would have been a very different movie.
Grease Lightning. Hold on a second. Hold on.
Wait, and he would be supposed to be a high schooler too.
No,
yeah.
He'd need to be like, you know, the phys ed coach, like the Sid Caesar. Elvis.
Or even the pedophile at the school dance.
Oh, the talk show host, the show host, the host.
Yeah, host.
Hits on Marnie. I think that movie, Grease, because I saw it so young, it was the first time I saw nudity in a film because of the blue moon scene when they moon the TV.
Yeah.
Like, that's how young I was when I saw Grease.
More Meatloaf and Richard O'Brien facts. Richard O'Brien was concerned that Meatloaf might not be able to handle that one number, Hot Patootie, Bless My Soul, which is another favorite of mine. Actually, I think all of these songs are my favorite song in the movie because every single one I was like, oh no, this is my favorite. Another one wouldn't happen. But anyway.
Did they, like, who wrote the book to this? Was it the same guy who wrote the story and everything? Like, did this all just come out of him?
No, I think somebody else might have done the actual music. Right. I'm not sure.
I mean, there's
I actually
some...
didn't read about the music.
That Meatloaf song, I swear, it
it's
sounds
so
like
good.
It seems like, but it feels like Elton John wrote it or something. Yeah. Like, the music in this is just that good. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. But so he was concerned that Meatloaf might not be able to handle it because he, I guess in the stage production, no one had ever actually managed to sing the whole thing correctly. And so he brought out the music and handed it to Meatloaf and he said, it's okay if you flub a few lines. No one in London ever managed to sing this. And so Meatloaf looked at it and he was like, what's the problem? And then he sang the whole thing without skipping a beat.
Whoa. So.
Mr. Paradise by the Dashboard Light mm-hmm. right there, man. Yeah. I love how he looked at it and he's like, I don't see the problem.
Yeah.
What a pro.
Yeah, yeah. Truly. Meatloaf also said, apparently Meatloaf is like the only like cast member who's actually like done a lot of like interviews about this for various reasons, but he said that preparations for the motorcycle scene saw several accidents on set. His stuntman drove the motorcycle through the scene, including the up and down the ramps, and the bike fell off the top tier and landed upside down, pinning the stuntman underneath it, and Meatloaf ran over and somehow managed to be the hero of this story by mustering enough strength to lift the heavy bike off of him just enough so he could move. And the stuntman didn't move for some time, but eventually opened his eyes and told everyone he was okay, and later told him that that is actually an old stuntman trick to make sure you're not suffering any pain or serious injuries before you move, because your spinal cord could be in danger. But they also needed to get shots of Meatloaf riding the bike up and down the ramps. So the crew rigged up this wheelchair that would hold a set of handlebars and a motorcycle windshield in front of the camera as the crew pulled it up and down the steps. But when they're in the middle of shooting, the wheelchair hit a ridge at the bottom of the steps, which sent him flying and shattered both the camera and the windshield. And his stuntman tried to catch him, but in the process, the ramp like caught his leg and he suffered a serious fracture. And Meatloaf also suffered a deep cut on his head, but I was unable to verify whether that's the cut we see in the movie. Like the actual cut on his forehead.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that was makeup or real. That would have been cool if that's a real cut, but
yeah.
Wow. That's like a crazy motorcycle stunt story.
All motorcycle stunt stories are crazy motorcycle stunt stories.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, too many words in that sentence. Just great. Wow. Yeah, I never driven a motorcycle. They've always seemed too dangerous to get off for me. For my liking.
I was on a motorcycle one time and I hated every second of it. Although I think that if I was on one now, I would love it. Mm. But I definitely thought I was
going to
die
10
years ago when I was on one.
There's a funeral home, like, around the corner from me, and I notice that when they have their garage door open, there's a motorcycle in there, and I find that really interesting because I feel like if you're dealing with dead bodies a lot of those bodies are going to be motorcycle accidents, you know?
Interesting.
So it's
I'm curious. For some reason, my mind went to motorcycle hearse.
Okay.
Like, okay. Like, I don't know what that would be, but like towing the coffin behind you somehow?
That sounds awesome. apparently Vincent Price was actually offered the role of the criminologist/narrator,
yeah.
But had to turn it down due to scheduling conflicts, which is very unfortunate because I would
he
love
would have
to
been
see that.
Great.
Yeah. Apparently he was very interested in the role because he had seen it. The stage play and loved it.
Yeah, this seems like it would be like definitely his sensibilities. Like, that's funny you mention it because it kind of, now that you mention it, it feels like he's kind of missing from this somewhere. Like, he should be there. Yeah, like it's an ode in part to the work that he put out there.
Oh, for sure. Mick Jagger wanted to play Dr. Frankenfurter. That is also a version of this movie that I would love to see. With like Mick Jagger, Elvis, David Bowie. Like, who's your dream cast? Vincent Price.
Mick Jagger could also play the mouth that sings the song in the beginning,
yes.
too. He's got that big mouth of his.
So when I was in Montreal for the summer,
when I first got there, there was like there's a big circus festival, and part of the circus festival is that the students from one of the really good circus schools like perform in the street, and then they like perform in the street all day, and it leads up to like this show that they do all together. And one of the acts this year was a swinging trapeze act, which is just like a trapeze bar that swings back and forth, and you do tricks like on top of it and underneath it. It was a swinging trapeze act to Sweet Transvestite.
Oh.
And it was like, one, it was a beast of an act, but like, I was just so happy that I was like, wow, it's acceptable to watch this in the street. There mm-hmm. are families here, and like, it wasn't just the one person performing, like, the whole cast of all the kids is like, you know, down there performing to this song. And I was just like, this is great. I feel happy right now.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's
so that wouldn't be cool everywhere. And it's great that I was in a place and that a lot of us get to live in a place where that just flies and it's normal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because like, that's how it just should be, right? Like, everywhere. And, like, imagine if, like, the people in charge weren't in charge back when this movie came out. Like, it could have gained so much more ground, and I don't know. I think about that sometimes, you know, like, this movie is just so far ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. But it was also representing what was happening at the time. You yeah. know, like, this was not even new to the people involved. Like, this is what their life was. And it's just crazy, like, 30 years later, like, American society, at least, like, is still having trouble. Like, we've come a long way, definitely, and, like, made great strides. But I just feel like, wow, at this point, like, you know, this should just be on prime time or something.
Well, it was. I mean, they did that yeah. Production of it on Fox.
That's right. Yeah. Time. Okay. So there, there you go. I guess we are. Yeah, it is a little better.
On Fox of all networks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
All right. Good. Good. So.
Interestingly, though, when Brad and Janet are in the car driving the car in the rain, on the radio, they are listening to Nixon's resignation, which I think happened. So they say that this is taking place sometime on a cold November evening, cold November rain. but Nixon resigned at some other point in the year, and I can't find the note in my notes right now. But Richard O'Brien explained that difference by saying that Brad was just the kind of guy who had a recording of Nixon's resignation speech and just like listened to it regularly, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, I thought that was just another sort of political jab at, you know, the system and mm-hmm. just for politics at the time.
But also like setting a contextual kind of backdrop of like what is going on in the culture, kind of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it says, like, there's so, that Nixon just carries so much weight to him in general, you know? Like, that's what I was sort of saying earlier, where, like, you could just take it as a joke, like, oh, they're kind of, like, making fun of Nixon, or you could say, like, no, like, the politics and the values of America at the time were, like, seriously screwed. Like, mm-hmm. there was a lot of, you know, Vietnam and all that kind of, I mean, mm-hmm. that was still going on and fresh. And so to sneak in Nixon in there like that is definitely, you know, there's a deeper context to it that sort of is permeated across the entire movie. It's like why they're making this movie is to break out of, it's the counterculture of the time, basically. It's like to, like, we are against Nixon. And so, like,
right.
you know, we just want to remind you, like, yes, he is out of office. Like we got rid of that, and so hopefully these are like the people leading the way. Unfortunately that didn't exactly happen, but I mean it is happening, it's still trying to happen, so you know.
Yeah, so I mean, but also, you know, before World War II, before like Hitler's rise to power, this was happening in Germany. Like, it's not mm-hmm. these things have always been happening, and we, you know, like the,
I think of like Cabaret, right?
Exactly.
Like,
that's yeah. set during the Weimar period in Germany, but also just like what the queer ancestors have been like written out of history, but like they didn't, like, queerness didn't get invented in the 20th century, you know? Like, this is, people have always had different sexualities and different ways of expressing their gender and that sort of thing, like, just dating back throughout human history, and we don't talk about it a lot, but it's there if you look for it, and I'm always, like, excited to see more pieces of meat, like, more kind of historical fiction that does it like, involve that kind of representation, because we definitely don't get enough of it, and so it's, like, easy to think that what we're going through is the first time that anyone's ever gone through this, but it's, like, there's been this kind of push and pull throughout history.
That book, I don't know if I have... This story, Orlando, it was, like, a famous book, too, right? That's what I kind of go back to, too. It was, like, that had been around for a long time, you know? And that's about a person who goes back from being a man and then becomes a woman for a few years and then becomes a man for a few years. So, like, yeah, it's definitely there in literature, in history and stuff. But I agree with you. Like, it just... It's been repressed, you know, by who is ever in charge, because it doesn't make them comfortable. Whereas... there's people where it's like, well, this is what makes me comfortable. This is me in my comfort zone and that kind of thing. And so I would much rather live in a world where that person's in charge. So hopefully we can get there.
Yeah.
Do we just bring this to a political grinding halt, like every time we talk politics?
Sometimes we do that.
I think that's isn't that like a social anomaly, though? Like, at some point, like, everyone stops talking at a party and there's just like a break of silence and everyone just like looks at each other and goes like, that was weird. And then like commences.
Yeah. No, I'm just looking through my voluminous notes to see if there's anything that I missed.
Oh, I wrote down Madonna, pre-Madonna. I wrote that a lot. especially the final floor show. I was like, oh, come on. Like, that's like her whole tour right there. And that's cool, but like, she, you know, there's another person who got a lot of shit for trying to represent too, you know? And like, everyone just like came at her for wearing a brassiere on stage and like, oh, I'm going to pretend to masturbate in front of everybody. Like, you know, like, people got up in arms about her, and it's just performance art, people. Yeah. Like, come on.
Well, I mean,
that's also what she wanted.
Yeah, that was her.
Yeah, thing. That is true. And that, I guess, kind of cheapened it a little bit for me.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know.
Not like, entirely. I still, believe me, I'm a material guy, a girl, whatever. I don't know. What do you call a male Madonna fan? But I've always
loved
her.
Well, it's just, it's, like, especially subversive for a woman to do it. You know, it like, it really, for, you know, it's one thing if it happens in the context of this, like, big, ridiculous musical. It's another thing entirely if a woman is standing on stage, if not by herself, surrounded by a bunch of hulky babes, you know, like, being a sexual being, where, like, in a way where it seems that she is in control. Was she entirely? Who knows? Probably not. But, like, through the history of, like, at least popular music, you know, like, women have always been sexualized, but they're being sexualized by other people versus, you know, putting oneself in that sexual position or sexual framework, doing it in such an aggressive way. I think that was the other thing that, like, really freaked people out, was that she was, like, aggressive about it, you know?
That's true.
When women are not supposed to, they're supposed to be these, you know, demure kind of Janets, you know, like, when she gets to the castle, and even, like, kind of up until that moment where she decides to consent to Frankenfurter in her bed, like, that's the kind of role that women are supposed to play versus, you know, going out there and saying, this is me and this is what I like, you know.
Yeah, I always just personally, I just feel a little out of my depth sometimes when, like, talking about, like, this kind of stuff in general sometimes, but, you know, just being a, you know, almost 40-year-old white guy, right? Like, I just sometimes feel like I don't, you know, I just can't see it from every angle.
Yeah, no, and that's and stuff.
So,
fine.
Like, I always, no I kind of worry about it sometimes, like, if, like, oh, that if I like, accidentally offend to some degree or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I always try and be mindful of that kind of thing in general. But, I mean, just in, because this movie isn't necessarily, like, the easiest movie to talk about. Like, it just brings up a lot of, like,
yeah.
you know, questions, feelings, you know.
And also, the language of it has changed so much in the 43 years mm-hmm. that it's been out.
But I also think, Mike, what you're saying is, like even I, as a woman, feel that way a lot of times. Because, yeah, I'm a woman, so, like, my experience is very different than that of, like, a white guy whose life is, like, pretty easy for the most part in a lot of ways. Because society made it that way. But even I feel uncomfortable talking about a lot of these things just because we don't practice mm-hmm. talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And... like, so much of it is just, like, my own experience and my, you know, limited worldview, because that's all I can know.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, so many times I really just want to stay quiet and, like, listen to other people because I want to try to understand better. And then that can help me understand my own experience better. So, like, even I feel like I have trouble talking about all of this.
Yeah, that's valid.
We're just not practiced at it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some people, like, are, but...
Yeah, well, you get better at it by doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And by listening and learning, because all you can know is your own experience. But it's important. Like, the thing that's kind of so... I mean, everything's terrible except for this one thing, which is that people are actually talking about it, you know, and that's really exciting because it not only moves the conversation forward, but it also gets everyone a little bit more comfortable
yeah.
with these things that especially in the United States, which is so our relationship to sex and sexuality is so fucked up in this country and so repressed in this country that, like, you know, it's gonna take some practice before people are comfortable with talking about it and, like, living it in, like, living their truth in whatever way that means.
Yeah, I'm just glad that we're all open to this kind of stuff too, and that I have friends that aren't closed-minded and everything. And so it's like, as moving forward, I feel like there's people out there that I can, you know, talk to and stuff about this, or we'll be able to, like, have this type of discussion, you know, without, like, arguing or anything like that, or, you know, getting angry at each other for things or anything. Like, we could be, you know, civil because we're genuinely, like, you know, interested and accepting of what we're trying to talk about.
Hmm. Something Tim Curry said during that Terry Gross interview that I listened to that I found really interesting was that when actors would ask him for advice for playing these characters, whether it be Frankenfurter or anyone else in a production of Rocky Horror, he would tell them, like, don't think about this is like doing drag. It's not that. This is just what everyone wears in Transylvania. Like, this is just who they are, and, like, it's not a big deal, and they're just going about, like, this is just their lives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting lens to look at this movie through, where, you know, especially because people, you know, thanks to RuPaul's Drag Race and stuff like that, are so much more familiar with and more comfortable with drag and stuff like that. It's easy to then turn around and look at this movie as, like, oh, everyone's just doing drag, but these are characters that are being, like, fully inhabited and, like, living their lives versus putting on.
Right, they don't, like, turn into something else mm-hmm. when they go to sleep at night mm-hmm. and wake up in the morning. Like, this is just who they are all the time.
Right.
That's good. I like that about that. You know, that they're not in costume, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, this is just who they are. Because that's like the whole vibe of sort of like, you know, I mean, I don't know because I'm straight, but like, not even just coming out, but like coming to terms with things and being like, no, that is me, sort of like owning it and not putting on masks anymore, or like, you know, dressing a certain way because like society has deemed that's the way to dress. It's like, no, just be yourself, like be it kind of
thing.
Don't dream it, be it. Yeah, that's his parting message. Even though, you know, Dr. Frankenfurter, he's an evil person, like, you know, from time to time, like, he's got a good idea. He's like Thanos. He just can't implement it correctly because he's insane. You know, it's like he wants to help. He wants to, like, do the right thing, but he's a madman. So, like, he doesn't have the thought process to do it that way.
Yeah. I haven't seen any of those movies, so I don't really get that reference, but I do know that he kills everyone. So.
Yeah, just the idea that he really wants to help, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, he just has the worst way of helping possible. But, like, he's like, I'm trying to do the right thing.
You know, I think, like, unfortunately, circling back to the Nazi stuff that we talked about, like clearly Hitler was super fucked up. But bad guys always think they're doing the right thing. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
Like,
there you go.
With the exception of maybe like Dr. Evil, who's like, I'm evil, you know, and I'm doing evil.
I talk to my therapist about this all the time. Like, most people are just doing their best and what they think is right. Like, all the time.
Yeah.
Right. And then along comes James Bond, right? I mean, like, every Bond villain is like that, where it's like, it's for the greater good, or like, I'm only trying to help humanity.
Right, they think their reasons are valid.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it okay, but that, you know.
It's the thought that counts sometimes, maybe? I don't know. No, it's tough. Like, I mean, there's like all these artists out there too that make great art that are just such assholes, you know what I mean? And it's like,
don't even get me started on that one.
I don't want to get a start. I'm trying to end it actually this point, but I feel it's sort of like the same thing. It's just like something snuck through the cracks with Frankenfurter, and he had one good line, like, yeah, you just, you know, at the end of the day, be yourself, even if, well, I tried to be myself, I almost destroyed everybody.
Yeah. Well, this is a little bit more in your wheelhouse, Mike, with your show, Third Time's a Charm. Did you read about the attempted sequels to the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
So I read about Shock Treatment, which was the actual sequel, right? It's like a pseudo-sequel, I heard. But I know nothing about a part three.
Well, not necessarily a part three, because Shock Treatment was technically not a part two. But
I'm still doing pseudo sequels. We're gonna do like the Cornetto trilogy and stuff. So
yeah.
In 1979, Richard O'Brien wrote a projected sequel to the film entitled Rocky Horror Shows His Heels. The script would have featured the return of all the characters from the original film, and O'Brien wished to largely use the original production team to make the new film. However, Jim Sharman, who I think was the director, did not want to revisit the original concept so directly, and Tim Curry did not wish to reprise his role. So instead, in 1981, the director reunited with O'Brien to film Shock Treatment, which was a standalone that was not a direct sequel to the original film. The film, as originally conceived and written in 1980 under the title The Brad and Janet Show, using most of the songs from the original Rocky Horror Shows His Heels project with lyrical adjustments and depicting the characters' continuing adventures in the town of Denton. However, these plans had to be adjusted due to a Screen Actors Guild strike. And then he tried, like, a couple more times to do a sequel, and they fell apart and just never got it together.
It's too bad.
Well, I think that's okay.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it is so one of a kind. The sequel is like, I didn't even know about it until like last year, you know. I just sort of stumbled upon that. And it sounds insane. Like, they build, like, Denton becomes like a the entire town is like a television studio. It's almost like the Truman Show, except that like residents are either extras or part of shows and stuff. And like Janet and Brad go on a game show and get assigned to like either a soap opera or like something else. And I don't know. It sounds pretty twisted, but I haven't checked it out yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, but I would like to.
My last note on here that I had, actually, this kind of relates a little. It's kind of a connection to Keanu Club. It's kind of a Jordan connection as well to Keanu Club.
Is it a hot dog reference? It's
100%.
It's just when they cut off Janet and she just goes, "You're a hot dog."
I laughed so hard when that happened.
That was amazing.
I laughed.
Yeah, so I mean, I can't even look at a hot dog the same way ever again, let alone like hear the word hot dogs, like because of Cage Club. It's great. Yeah, I'm not complaining. I'm actually happy about it.
Check out that episode of Keanu Club. What was that? Flying Dream.
There's Flying, which I just cannot recommend enough. I don't think I've talked a single person into watching it, except for the one person who I made sit down next to me and watch it.
I have not seen it, and I talked somebody into watching it the other day. So.
Whoa, good for you. It's on YouTube in full.
Yeah, I know.
It might be called Dream to Believe. Anyway, there's an excellent hot dog scene that I had to watch 3 times, and I had to stop it because I was laughing so hard. And then in Sweet November, there's a hot dog speech. You gotta sell hot dogs.
Yep. Yeah, he's marketing hot dogs. He's giving a whole sell on it.
That's amazing.
Oh, and I mean, then there's Dog Eat Dog. Mike, did you do that one with us?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's Dog Eat Dog, which didn't have hot dogs exactly, except it did feature a scene where two characters sprayed ketchup and mustard all over each other, which I thought was close enough.
Yeah, Cage and Willem Dafoe, they're having a ketchup and mustard fight in their hotel
room. For no reason.
No.
Just saw the other day, Willem Dafoe is in they made another movie about Vincent van Gogh, like his later period, and cast Willem Dafoe as a 60-something-year-old.
Oh.
Which, I mean, what? I like Willem Dafoe. Don't get me wrong. He would have made a great Van Gogh in his 30s. It's just, you know, whatever. Anyway.
Well, he's got to be better than Kirk Douglas, right? Like, didn't Kirk Douglas play Van Gogh at one point?
Know.
He's like, I'm Vincent Van Gogh. I'm going to cut off my ear.
Mike, that's for sure your best impression yet.
Thanks.
Well, we were talking before we started recording, and you mentioned the Rocky connection.
To Rocky Balboa.
Yeah.
I never put that together either. Like, that there were two Rocky movies out there, whole, like, kind of separate threads, and that people were getting them confused. That's adorable. I would love someone to show up at like a midnight screening of Rocky Balboa dressed as Frankenfurter going what?
Or even just do like a midnight double feature of one of the Rocky movies with Rocky Horror.
It'd be funny if the Rocky Balboa movie, like the Stallone movie, turned out to be like the midnight movie people got dressed up to like quote along with and everything, and like you get Polly lookalikes in there. Like,
oh, if you just go by the Philadelphia Art Museum anytime, day or night, there's somebody running up the steps and yelling Adrian. So it's you can get a little taste of that there. But one of the taglines for the movie was another kind of Rocky. And another movie that came out in 1975, Jaws, they had one of the one of the posters was the Rocky Horror logo, the red lips, and then underneath it said a different set of Jaws.
Oh, I like that. I like the whole marketing campaign.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was so much like a coordinated marketing campaign as like at different times they just used different slogans. Mm.
Nowadays, it would be a whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
In fact, I think it feels like Deadpool, like went to market the new movies. Mm-hmm. They like any movie that a Fox Blu-ray was re-released with like him on the cover. It's like, just in case you didn't know, like, what if Deadpool was in Pretty Woman? Wouldn't that be funny?
Actually, I'd watch
Come
that.
To think of it, as yeah. Julia Roberts, too, not as Richard
no,
Gere.
Definitely as Richard Gere. How could you possibly cast Julia Roberts? She's a treasure. Some of the other taglines, he's the hero. That's right, the hero.
What?
Yeah, that was not great. Give yourself over to absolute pleasure. I think that's the one that I probably saw the most often. Which I think
that's
one.
Also the Hellraiser tagline. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen a Hellraiser movie, but the idea is like you open up the puzzle box and out pops Pinhead, and he's like, "You have unleashed the ultimate pleasure, which is pain." And like at that point, the guy who opens the box is like, "Oh shit, I'm about to get my flesh torn off, but have like the most intense orgasm of my life." And that's pretty much Hellraiser.
Wow, you know, I have not ever seen any of the movies because I was so scared of the video covers in the video store when I was a kid. But speaking of hot dogs, I did find a project on Pinterest the other day where somebody had created a Hellraiser head out of hot dogs with toothpicks.
Yes,
what?
Yes.
yeah, that was pretty good. Definitely not my kind of cooking, but I might try that because it looks ridiculous. Oh, don't dream it, be it. That was another tagline. The 1990 15th anniversary video release, they used "Dream it in your living room, be it in the theater," which is okay.
All right.
And then the 2025th anniversary tagline was 25 years of absolute pleasure.
Nice. Sort of celebrating all the anniversaries, really.
So if you guys were characters in Rocky Horror, who would you be?
Okay, so I'm probably one of the weirdos at the party. Like, I just don't know if I have, if I'm a lead. Mm-hmm. If I were a lead, I'd probably be a riffraff.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah, I like the whole hunchback thing, and then at the end, I loved his hair where he put it up in like the ponytail going forward thing.
Yeah.
That's really
cool. And you get to wear thigh-high fishnets. We see a little riffraff leg.
Hey, yeah, sure.
How about you, Jordan?
I don't know.
You said you had the magenta hair. Oh, no, that was you, Kara.
No,
right?
That was Kara.
Kara. My bad.
I mean, I always identified as magenta, but then when I was watching it this time, I was like, oh, no. Am I a Janet? Because she faints a lot.
I think I'm a Janet.
And she gets really cranky when she's cold and wet, and so do I.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think it's like, I feel like we do this every time we have to choose characters. We're like, well, I'm a little bit this one and a little bit this one. Like, I'm Janet mixed with somebody else.
Yeah.
Because I'm not full Janet.
No.
I don't know. I don't know who I'd mix myself with.
That's fine.
Like, maybe half Janet, half Columbia.
Yeah, I could see that. That was what I was going to say.
Yeah.
You'd look fantastic in a sequined.
I want that outfit so bad.
Me too.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, who would you be?
Well, I guess the obvious comparison is magenta. Because okay. Even...
But like half Janet, half magenta.
Maybe, yeah. Although, you know, in high school I would have gone with the red-haired magenta, but now that I have... dark hair, like my natural color hair, and also some grays growing in strategic spots. You could definitely pull off that look from the end with the Bride of Frankenstein hair. But
well,
I don't
right.
know if that's
at the
like
end. She's got
I
it
am.
Up like the bride.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
Yeah, I love that costume.
Oh, so Kara, okay. If you had to choose, are you going to be outer space magenta? Ready to go back in her gear there with the hair, or Auntie Entity in the chainmail?
I'm gonna have to Google that.
That's Tina Turner in Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, I don't have to Google it. You guys
Google
told me
it
about
anyway,
that song.
She looks
I listened
amazing.
To the song.
Isn't the song great?
It's a good song. Yeah.
You have to see the movie. It's so good. God, that's hard. Well. Magenta doesn't have similar a 200-pound costume. Yeah.
Whoa. True there, yeah.
Yeah, she Tina Turner's costume weighed like 210 pounds because it was all steel mail. It was made out of steel.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and wearing high heels. Can you believe that? Tina Turner, jeez, a true powerhouse.
A treasure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't know. I got to go with Tina Turner. Every all time. Right. Yeah.
Maybe not the most fair question, so.
No, they're both such good costumes.
Yeah, it's a toss-up, maybe.
But yeah, no, I think I'm a Janet, mostly, with a bit of magenta, some Columbia, a large dollop of Frankenfurter, and like a sprinkle of Eddie on top, maybe.
Oh, I might be. That's funny. I was so I brought up earlier, you know, while we talk about how people dress up and go to this and everything like that. I actually remember having that conversation once and saying, like, I would actually dress up as Eddie. Like, I would do that. I would go that far, you know? I would, whatever, he's got, like, the cut on his head and sort of, like, the leather jacket and everything. Like, I could do that. I see myself doing that. I could dress up like Eddie.
Hey, does anyone else have anything to add about Rocky Horror before we wrap this up?
I don't think we mentioned this, but Richard O'Brien, when he wrote this, was living as an unemployed actor in London during the early 70s, and he mostly just wrote this because he was bored.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
It's like one winter and he was bored.
I love that this is just from his mind, too. Like,
yeah,
it's
wild.
Boom.
That, like, this could, I mean, obviously it takes like a lot of people to put on a production like this, and like it's nothing without the production design and the costumes and everything, but like the fact that like so much of it could have sprang from one person's twisted mind, I love it.
All right, Kara, you got anything to plug?
I don't think so. Actually, I was recently on Mike's podcast, Third Time's a Charm, where we were talking about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and Tina Turner in all of her glory. So definitely listen to that. Or if you just go to cageclub.me/Kara, you can find all of the episodes that I've been on with other Cage Club shows. And I think that's kind of all I have going on right now. You can follow me on Instagram at Bimpse, BIMPSE. And yeah, that's it.
Mike, what do you got?
All right. So, yeah, definitely check out Kara on the Mad Max episodes, plural, because it was so much Mad Max. We had
split
it into two. So episodes 7 and 8.
A real marathon recording session.
Yeah. And Kara and Brian joins us. So Brian from your Grease episode. Your listeners would be familiar with his velvet voice. So that's Brian Late Night Rodriguez over there in the Thunderdome. And Kara Dr. Greens.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so...
my new apocalypse name.
Yeah. And... you could also, I was recently on Kyle Reinfried's podcast, Foodie Films, talking about The Great Soylent Green.
Love that movie.
So that's ditched. Check out that movie. Definitely great. Joey and I are wrapping up Watch the Throne. We've got about, well, probably like, we're really coming down to the wire. We've got like 2 or 3 more movies at the time of this recording, and maybe like 5 or 6 more episodes to go until that's wrapped up for the first phase. And then we will be announcing soon, we're doing some new shows next year, in the new year. Joey and I are going to do 2 new shows. Right now, they haven't been officially announced, but stay tuned for that. So, always a lot of new stuff. Oh, and we just wrapped up talking about all the Christopher Nolan movies over on Cinemakers. That's me, Joey, and Chris Mattiello from Now and Again. So lots of stuff out there. I don't even realize until I say it all out loud just how much damn stuff I've been on. Really.
Yeah.
But that's a lot. But yeah, lots of great stuff over on the network. I really feel like September's been a great month for content. I've been so happy listening to everybody's shows and stuff. So, like, I'm really looking forward to October. I think there's going to be a lot of Halloween-themed stuff out there.
Hell yeah, there is.
This, this is our transition into Halloween.
Yeah, this is actually a September episode, but I've already started my horror movie marathon. Like, Halloween is in full swing.
Kara was like, let's get to it.
I know. I'm so there already. I'm in my mind, it's October for sure. So, yeah, all that great stuff, cageclub.me.
Sweet. I'm coming up sometime on a Watch the Throne episode. I'm going to be on one of those few that are left. I don't know when. Pretty soon, though. If you haven't listened to it yet, go back and listen to our Grease crossover episodes. They were pretty great. We did a two-part Grease episode, one on this podcast, and the other one was on the High School Slumber Party podcast with Brian. Also, if you haven't watched Grease since you were a child, go take a look at it. Super weird.
And if you haven't watched Rocky Horror since you were a teen, take a look at it. Super weird. Better than you remember.
This episode wraps up our musical month.
Yep.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're using it as a transition into our spooky. October episode. Spooky. So those will be coming up soon. Kara and I are potentially working on a mini podcast that we're super into that we tested out on mic. Before we started
show
recording,
on Earth. That's all I know.
I don't know why we didn't just hit record and make that the first one. Our bad. We'll try again next time.
We can't capture that magic. That bottle is already broken, but we'll get another jar.
Yeah, you all missed out. That was pretty great. You can find me on Instagram at JordoPC. You can see all the Cage Club episodes. I'm on cageclub.me/Jordan. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Michael ran me with silver day, the earth stood still. But he told us where we stand. And Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in cellular jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space. And this is how the message ran. Science fiction. Double feature.